This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. It's Health and Living on The Bigger Picture. My name is Sina Camilla. It's Monday. That means that it's Health News Digest. And joining me this week is Live and Learn producer Cho Antek.
Hello.
So this week, our theme for Health News Digest is brain health. The first topic that we're going to cover is about football and its potential link to long-term brain damages.
Okay, this refers to a study in the UK that shows footballers who hit footballs may be more likely to suffer from brain damage. The Football Association says it will look into this area more closely going forward.
And the second story is about how abnormal sleep may be linked to obesity risks.
And the third story is about sounds to relax, meditate. This is a story for those who have trouble falling asleep. These are a sample of the sounds that you can look for online that is free to help you with your sleep issues.
So that's what we have for this hour, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon, it's Health and Living on The Bigger Picture. My name is Tina Camellia and in the studio with me is Cho Antek. The first story that we're going to cover this week on Health News Digest is how football headers may be linked to brain damage. And recently, I think in 2015, Will Smith was in a film called Concussion. They were exploring American football, so the NFL, and how their players have potential of getting brain damages later on in their lives after their retirement. Will Smith played the doctor, Dr. Bennett Omalu, who is a Nigerian doctor. He was the first to discover sport-related brain trauma. And here's a short clip from Will Smith about the film itself.
It's the strangest thing, right? We watch it, we see the hits, you know, you see someone go down, they go off on the sidelines, and then you applaud when they come back 5 minutes later, you think they're okay. Once I had the science explained to me, it becomes so obvious that you can't imagine how you didn't see it before. And a big part of why I wanted to make this film was, as a parent, I didn't know I sent my child out there. And I think that at a minimum, you have to know so you can just make an informed decision. With the new science and the acceptance of it, I do believe that there will be scientific advancement in the next 5 to 10 years that will be extremely helpful. But, you know, for today, there's really nothing to do other than, you know, bang your head less.
Do you watch football or American football?
No, I tried to watch it, but I think the rules were too complicated for me. Because we don't get easy access to it, at least I don't think when I still had a cable subscription. But I remember this show, I remember this movie when it came out, because there was a lot of marketing hype around it, and it is on my to-watch list. I haven't got around watching it yet. And I guess the movie reminds me of the case about tobacco, maybe in the 60s, when it seems obvious that it's related, it's a cause for cancer, but no one or no scientist seems to be able to produce a conclusive study. And now, I guess the story is focused on sugar, right? A lot of fast food companies and soda companies are attempting to divert it away from sugar and instead to blame it on fats. So the story that was featured in this film, Concussion, I guess for football in the UK is not yet at that tipping point where a lot of research or different independent research are coalescing around the same conclusion that this act of hitting the ball repeatedly week in, week out, or every day for professional footballers actually would lead to brain damage. Because it seems commonsensical as well, right? If you repeatedly have trauma on your head, that it's only natural that your brain will suffer from it.
I don't watch football, but in a regular game, like when you watch football, is it often that players would head the ball?
I think, yeah, almost every other minute. Depending, especially in the English game, I think, because now in the Spanish game, the trend is more focused on this thing called tiki-taka. So it's very quick movements, very quick passing. But in the English game, there's a lot of long balls. You know, they hit from defense to striker, bypassing the midfielder. That's one way of getting the ball to the striker, which is, I guess, the focus of this study was a striker named Jeff Astle. He's a West Brom striker from the 60s and 70s, and he was a very proficient header of the ball. That's the classic center forward role, right? You, a defender or midfielder will hit the ball up the pitch, and then it is the role of the striker to either hit the ball on to a runner to further the attack, or to hit the ball towards the goal to score.
Right. So Jeff, he was highlighted in this BBC article because he died at the age of 59 from early onset dementia. Dementia normally, you will start seeing signs and symptoms around 65 years. It starts to manifest around 75 years of age. So his is really an early onset dementia. And his daughter was speaking to the BBC Radio 5 to talk about his case. And she was saying that it's unforgivable what the Football Association is doing because they were trying to sweep it under the rug and not acknowledge that his career might have had something to do with his dementia.
When we knew the disease had really got a hold of him, you know, he was surrounded by England caps, FA Cup winners' medal, League Cup winners' medal, everything he'd won in football, but he remembered none of it, even though he'd ever been a footballer. Everything football gave him, football ended up taking away. And he didn't recognise me or my sisters. He was just a shell. It was just desperately sad, desperately brutal. I wasn't ready to lose him. And I just feel very sad. And I feel very angry that I felt that football, at the coroner's inquest, football tried to sweep his death under a carpet. They didn't want to know. They didn't want to think that football could be a killer. And sadly, it is. It can be.
So two universities in the UK, the University College London and Cardiff University, presented tentative evidence based on a very small study. The sample size is just five professional football players and one amateur football player who was a committed player. He was playing for 26 years. And so based on that very small study, they found that all six participants in the study developed dementia by their 60s.
Yeah, I was very struck by the fact that Jeff, as the only was diagnosed with dementia, early onset of Alzheimer's, when he was 55, and he passed away at 59. So the decline was very rapid and very sudden. And is this normal in cases of dementia where the
rate of progression,
the deterioration?
Yeah. It really depends from case to case. Dementia is kind of the umbrella term for things like Alzheimer's, and sometimes all these symptoms present themselves differently.
So the daughter Dawn that we heard in the clip, she's alleging or insinuating there is a larger malicious kind of cover-up by the Football Association, or rather they are not keen on investigating further. Was there any proof from her to substantiate that claim? Because, I don't know, it might be just a case of ignorance, right? No one thought to make the link and no study ever came out of it.
But I think this study is trying to change that and trying to get the Football Association to be more proactive in the health of their players. I mean, after the study was published, the Football Association said that they welcome the study and they are determined to support the research, the larger scale research eventually, because the brain injury is linked to memory loss, to depression. And it's also, you can also see similar symptoms in other sports where there's direct impact to the head. So rugby, American football, as we discussed earlier, boxing, definitely. So now they're trying to make that association with football, which is mainly a foot game. You play it on the ground. But because I think it's also because of the impact of the ball at very high velocity, that even if you don't get as much, the ball doesn't hit your head as many times as, let's say, a punch to a boxer, it still has some impact to your life later on.
Yeah, I wonder how it's going to change the game, because from the time when Jeff was playing the game, they've changed the ball, right? It used to be heavier, it's made of leather. Now the ball is much lighter and flies faster as well. So maybe it's less damaging. But has it changed any rules at all in the other sports that you cited, rugby, boxing? I mean, it's hard to for boxing to not involve hitting the face.
Yeah. And I think that's also why amateur boxing, for example, the boxers have to wear headgear. And what I know is, I think last year or a couple of years ago, in American soccer, at least in the women's league, because of a very high profile case of a female soccer player getting a head injury, she started wearing this headgear. So it's kind of like a headband, but it also has some protective feature to prevent concussion and other forms of brain trauma. And also in little leagues and junior soccer or football in the US, they are trying to petition to ban heading the ball. So you won't develop your heading skills until much later on. So I don't know how that will change the game, because heading is one of the skills that you need to know how to do when you're playing professional football. So if you don't develop that from young, then your game above your head will be very poor. So it might change the game.
Well, lose a skill, but you live longer, maybe.
And when we come back, we're going to go to topic number two about sleeping. BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. It's Health and Living on The Bigger Picture. My name is Tina Carmelia, and joining me in the studio is Chua Eun Teck. Today, we are discussing topics related to brain health. We've curated a selected few stories that caught our attention. And this first one, we were talking about how football headers are being linked to brain damage later in life. And in the second topic, we're discussing abnormal sleep and how it could be linked to obesity risk. So the University of Glasgow examined the interactions of sleeping habits and genes with obesity. And it's based on data that they collected from the biobank, which is, it's kind of like a repository of genetic materials from as many as 120,000 British citizens. So these are people who give their genetic samples so that researchers have access to them and they could carry out research like this. And so apparently this study showed that if you sleep too much or if you sleep too little, you could increase your risk of obesity.
Yeah, the main takeaway I got from this article is that you really are, I mean, your lot in life really is determined a lot by the genetic lottery of your birth, right? Because this, the caveat of the story is that certain people who have been, people who have this genes are more affected by their sleep habits, bad sleep hygiene habits. So I'm not sure how useful it would be for the average reader or the lay reader, like, because for this information to be useful, you need to know whether or not you possess that gene. And beyond that, it's always good to have good sleep practice, right? But stories like this might be alarming, perhaps, to people who are just skimming the headlines and not looking at the details of the research.
And you're right about how, because regardless of your diet, regardless of your sociodemographic group, your health status, if you sleep too little or too much while having this gene, you might just be gaining weight later on. And as much as 4 kilograms if you sleep too long, and as much as 2 kilograms if you sleep too little. And what's too long or too little? Before we get to that, I sent our intern Joyce to the streets of Bandar Utama to suss out the average, well, by average, I mean like 10 people.
People we see around Bandar Utama during lunchtime.
Yeah. So we asked them how long they sleep.
5 to 6 hours a day.
I sleep around like 4 to 5 hours when I'm working. But when I'm not, 6 to 7 hours.
9 out of 10 times I get 8 hours of sleep.
One day I sleep is 6 hours.
5 to 6?
It varies. Sometimes I get 1 hour of sleep. Sometimes I get up to 13 hours of sleep. So it's a huge difference.
I find it very alarming that people are not sleeping enough. I sleep for about 8 to 9 hours a day. I go to bed around 10. I wake up around 6, 6:30. How about you?
I think you are a tiny, tiny minority in KL, like 9 to 10. Well, I always strive to sleep at least 8 hours, but I think I'm more in line with the general average of what we heard just now, like 6 or under 6, because I know it's bad, but I don't know. Maybe I can learn something a thing or two about you from you about how to get the necessary shut eye.
Yeah, because what constitutes a long sleep is anything beyond 9 hours, and what constitutes too short of sleep is anything less than 7 hours. So
should you be aiming to sleep for 9 hours? Because you won't, just because you're lying on a bed doesn't mean you're sleeping, right?
That's right.
You're still conscious, you're thinking about work tomorrow, you're stressed. That's another issue altogether, right? To meditate and clear your mind. But yeah, so how much should you aim for to get to bed and just to get the right amount of sleep?
I think, like, for me, I would start getting ready to go to bed by around 10. I probably fall asleep around 10:30. If I have a rough day, it's probably 11. So I give myself about half an hour to an hour just to fall asleep. And I try not to be on my phone, although sometimes I am. It's really just developing the habit of, you know, having a set time to go to bed. Having a set time to wake up. And normally you will know when you have a good sleep because you probably wake up before your alarm rings. I have my alarm, but normally I wake up just maybe a few minutes before my alarm. So because of the consistency with regards to when I go to bed and when I wake up.
Yeah, waking up before your alarm is a good idea because snoozing is just the worst.
I never snooze. I switch off that function because if I start making that a habit, I worry that I would just lose control of my discipline. I think I take a bit of pride in the fact that I have pretty decent sleep hygiene.
Yeah, and research is conclusive that pressing the snooze button is the equivalent of getting hit by a bus for your brain, because it's so, your brain is ready to wake up, but then you go back to sleep, and so it has to restart the process all over again in 5, 10, 15 minutes, depending on how long you're snoozing. But when you mentioned earlier that you take about half an hour to go to bed, but what if you're in bed for about an hour and you're not asleep yet?
Oh, I don't know what to do with that.
Because I've heard advice that you should, because you're not sleeping anyway, you should maybe pick up a book with a dim light and read it until you fall asleep, because you could be productive with that time that you're not doing anything anyway.
Right. And it's also genetically linked. We've had a show with Dr. Arif Anwar talking about how genetics could be the reason for why you may be an early bird or a night owl. So if you're just genetically linked to be a night owl, then you shouldn't force yourself to be an early sleeper if you're just not meant to sleep that early. As long as you get that 7 to 9 hours, I think that's fair enough.
Did Dr. Arif Anwar tell us how to find out whether or not we are a night owl or
I suppose you're going to have to take a genetic test with him.
So it is possible to tell.
I suppose so, because they've identified the genetics behind that.
So just like how you mentioned earlier that the study took a sample of people's gene, 120,000. By doing a gene test, we can tell everything. We can tell what are we at risk for later in life, whether or not I'll suffer from male pattern baldness. Am I a night owl? Is that the idea of a genetic test?
There's a huge divide in the genetic community from what I know from the geneticists whom I've spoken to. Some are very pro-genetic tests, because, well, if you know your genetic predispositions for all these kind of potential medical problems, you can take preventive steps to prevent it. But on the other hand, you also have the other group that says that you don't know yet what this information means, because it's just numbers. Let's say you're saying something like you have a 50% chance of developing breast cancer. When do you decide if it is a high risk or a low risk? It also depends on your lifestyle. So you could have a 50% chance of getting breast cancer, but you have a very healthy lifestyle. Your 50% chance might be decreased because of your environmental interaction, which is much better than someone who is also 50% chance of getting breast cancer, but has awful habits, smoking, eating junk food, drinking alcohol every day, that sort of stuff. So it's so subjective. The genetics itself is not going to really help you with it. It's a lot to do with, I think there's a lot of work right now in trying to educate people about what genetic tests are all about, and to take it, not to say to take it with a grain of salt, but to be very careful with the information that you get, because you don't want to make drastic decisions with your healthcare. You don't want to be doing a double mastectomy like what Angelina Jolie did just because you have a percentage. When do you decide? Is it 90%? Is it 95%? Is it 50%? So it's some ethical dilemma there.
Yeah, because having a 60% chance of developing cancer still means that you have a 40% chance of being healthy. And I suppose habits change as well, right? As kids and teenagers, they are more naturally predisposed to be night owls. They mm-hmm. tend to sleep later and wake up later. Hence, we have all this argument about try and make school start earlier because it's healthier for them. But as people grow older, maybe because through habit or just because of their genes, they tend to be early risers, right? There are mm-hmm. not many adults who are naturally night owls, I think.
So I suppose if you have a high genetic risk for obesity, which you have to find out first, then you want to be very careful about your sleep hygiene. Otherwise, I mean, I think it's just generally good advice to get enough sleep, 7 to 9 hours. I measure mine with my Samsung Gear, so I know when I go to bed, when I don't go to bed. But I also got our interns to Bandar Utama about whether or not they measure their duration of sleep. How do they know if they're getting 4 hours and 6 hours? And this is what they have to say.
I know it through, I don't know, I just count my own sleeping hours, what time I sleep and then what time I wake up. And yeah, that's how I know how long I slept.
I generally time, well, not time, but I'm aware when I go to sleep and when I wake up. That's how I know.
I know this because I have a strict bedtime routine. Because I have this thing where I sleep at around sharp 10 and then I wake up around 6. That's how I know. I've had this routine since I was a kid.
I have to take 6 hours sleep. Because I'm driving, I'm a personal driver, I have to enough sleep. So I know enough sleep, I cannot drive the car. So that's why I know that my time, what time I want to sleep, everything I do.
Most of the time, it become my habits, about 2, then I wake up about 7 or 8.
Usually I check the clock when I go to bed, and when I wake up, I check the clock again. So that's how I know. No fancy gadgets or apps for me.
Only for me, I suppose. How about you? Do you have something to track your sleep?
I have a smartphone which I tried using to track my sleep, but because it's not fancy enough to be able to track how well I sleep or how much I sleep on its own. So it requires self-reporting, me being honest with myself and the phone to key in the data as to what time I sleep and what time I wake up. So I thought after a while, it's pretty redundant because I am either cheating or it's just depressing.
Well, I don't rely on it. I've always been good with when I go to bed and when I wake up. But with an app, it helped me with, it helped me with being honest about when I'm playing truant, when I'm not actually going to bed early. And also helps me track my sleep quality as well, because I get to rate how I feel after I wake up. I suppose that could be a first step for anyone who wants to have better sleeping hours after hearing this story. Not to be an alarmist or anything, but I think it's just good practice to get enough sleep every night.
I agree. It's what all of us are lacking. A lot of us are lacking. Not you. I think you're very good on that aspect. But I think one last final point I would like to make is, how do you get around the thought that there's so much more you can do before the day is over?
Oh, I think
at 10 o'clock, you know, it's 2 more hours to the day. You feel like, wow, it's early. If I sleep at 11, I'll still get 7 hours of sleep if I'm going to wake up at 6 a.m. If an extra hour of day, I can do so much with it. How do you just go past that thought? Or do you not have that kind of thought?
I think I don't have that kind of thought because I subscribe to the mantra of let it go. It's true.
Yeah.
It's a very Buddhist teaching of learning to let go. Yeah, not just physical possessions, but also about selfishness around time and around, you know, I'm going to be a go-getter and I have to get a lot of things done. Just be able to let go.
Note taken. Thank you.
And we'll leave it at that, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. It's Health and Living on The Bigger Picture. My name is Tina Camilia. In the studio with me is Chua Eun Taek. Earlier, we've been talking about abnormal sleeping behavior being linked to risk of obesity. Before that, we were also talking about how brain damage may be caused by heading footballs. And the third story is about how sounds can help you relax, fall asleep, meditate, study. This might help some of the folks that we had heard earlier on about how they're not getting enough sleep. So this story was actually pitched by our colleague, Juliet Jacobs, because she was listening to some music that she found online and it had helped her with relaxing and falling asleep. And so I had a short conversation with her earlier about it. Earlier this week, you were telling me a little bit about the music that you listen to relax and fall asleep. Do you want to tell me more about that?
Yes, I am actually subscribed to this website called Open Culture. So they shared this article which said that Arctic music, someone had compiled, I think, 10 hours worth of Arctic sounds and had compiled it into this long playlist so that you could listen to it because it had shown that it will calm you down, it will relieve whatever stress you have and, you know, just basically make you feel a lot better. So I actually tried it to kind of get out some noise from my surroundings. And it actually worked. I found myself concentrating better because before I would listen to like my favorite music, but I found that it wasn't the best way. So this kind of this weird music which just blends into the background really actually helped. It's called the Relax Sleep ASMR YouTube channel and it offers 10 hours of Arctic ambient music. I know that sounds really, I suppose, maybe hippy-dippy, but, you know.
Very Bjorkish.
Very Bjorkish, yes, yes, because it's frozen ocean, ice cracking, snowfall, howling wind sorts of sounds. And also, you know, on that open culture thing that I was telling you about, they also provided another link from Moby. He suffered from chronic insomnia. He couldn't sleep. So he actually came up with 4 hours of ambient music. And I also listened to that. And actually, I found that even more helpful. It kind of just tunes out everything else, you know, all the surrounding noise and really helps you just concentrate on your work. And you can download that for free.
So you were asking earlier about some tips to get a better sleep. Maybe this one will help you.
Yeah, Moby. It kind of makes sense now why his music is like the way it is.
Do you listen to any music to help you fall asleep? Or?
Yes, I do. It's either music I'm very familiar with, so I don't have to think about it. I don't have to pay attention to the lyrics because I'm already familiar with it. But if not, then I guess instrumental tunes, not unlike what Moby has produced before.
Maybe you'll try him out tonight.
I think EDMs are quite relaxing as well.
EDMs, really?
You don't think so? I think the beats is very therapeutic. Because it's constant and there are highs and there are lows and it's more emotional rather than cerebral.
Wow, that's very deep.
I'm trying to get deep sleep, so maybe.
Right, okay. Because the science behind, I mean, sleep studies, we all know that there are two stages of sleep, the REM stage and then the non-REM stage. So sleep researchers have studied brain waves and they measure it with the EEG. Then they can measure your eye movement, your muscle tone. And they showed some relation between a sleeping brain and very low frequencies being able to enhance brain memory and also sleep. So it's the very low frequency. I don't know about the high low of the EDM because that's now going contrary with this research.
But isn't it very ironic that, well, the reason why people don't get good sleeps is because their brain is overstimulated. And so when you're trying to fall asleep, isn't it kind of counterintuitive? No, it's intuitive, but it's goes against the grain to stimulate your brain further with an external stimuli, which is music in this case.
Yeah, and that's why I don't play music because I think I'm quite a thinker when I'm listening to anything. I want to, it's like for me, watching films, also I know a lot of my friends hate watching films with me because I need to pause, I need to rewind, I need to think about what that person just said. Is there any like underlying message behind it? So it's the same with listening to music. If I have music on, I want to be listening to every single sound. And I was like, oh, what's that? Oh, I need to know the lyrics. I must Google the lyrics right now and sing along. So I personally don't play any music to help me fall asleep. But I also don't play music to, for example, to work, because this ambient music or the white noise music, they help with concentration and focus and memory. I just can't, I would be thinking or listening to the sound rather than actually doing my work or trying to fall asleep.
But normally people put on white noise or ambient noise because they want to drown out the other noise. Maybe it's the background chatter in a cafe, or maybe it's just general noise in a workplace setting.
That's, yeah, that makes sense. I just try to look for a quiet place. Quietness is what works for me.
Hard to find. I think it's increasingly hard to find a place like that because real estate is a luxury, I think. I mean, in the office and at home.
Yeah.
Sleeping pills, is that an option? Is that a healthy option?
See, the only time I've ever taken anything to help me fall asleep is melatonin pills when I was traveling and there's a huge time difference. So because of the jet lag and it was a work trip and I had to wake up in normal, like with everyone else, like be and function like a normal person. So I was taking some herbal melatonin pills to help me get my bio clock synchronized. That was the only time I've ever used any form of external help with falling asleep. And I only did it because it was a work trip and it was halfway around the world and I just had to function.
Yeah. We know all sorts of things that is bad if we don't get enough of sleep, but we don't know actually what sleep is for, right?
Are you sure about that?
I mean, is there, have we cracked the code on why we need sleep?
It has the potential of prolonging your life.
I mean, we'll definitely not live very long if we don't sleep at all. I mean, we know we need it, but we don't actually know what it does. We just know what happens when we don't get enough of it.
When we get enough of it, it also helps with forming our memory. When you're asleep is when your brain starts to solidify the neural pathways, the new ones, so that you can remember and recall things that you've learned, the experiences you felt throughout the day. So if you don't get enough of sleep, you might not register all this memory.
Yeah, which is why it's bad to cram and not sleep the night before an exam or an important interview or meeting.
Yeah, but I mean, philosophically speaking, I mean, some people are saying that sleep is for the weak, right? I don't know.
It's totally wrong. Right, that's factually wrong, right? We can say it with a lot of certitude that sleep is definitely not for the weak, unless you are a genetic freak. People like Margaret Thatcher or Bill Clinton, they only need 4 hours of sleep, right? Again, you are either blessed with a great genetic lottery and then you get an extra 4 hours of life every night. And for the rest of us, we just can't go against biology, I guess.
Yeah, so I guess a lot of our lifestyle has to do with our genetics. And we just have to live with it.
Yeah, and we have been adapting maybe to the wrong things because we adapt to our environment instead of adapting to our body and listening to what our body needs, taking on more things, pleasing more people. I guess that's the takeaway that we should have from
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. Mm-hmm. Yep. So I think that should wrap up our discussion today. And to lead us out, is a song by Marconi Union called Weightless. And this song was previously shown to be the most relaxing song based on research. It's shown to slow heart rate, reduce blood pressure, and decrease levels of cortisol, which is produced when you're under a lot of stress. This has been Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.